before.
Good morning, everyone. I'd like to open the March 19th, 2015 meeting of the House Agriculture and Natural Resources Committee. We are convened. Good morning to everyone. Today is Bee Day, and we'll be getting into that, Pollinator Day, I guess I should say, and we'll be getting into that very shortly. We have a couple of bills that we would like to move on out of this committee and onto the House floor. The first one is House Bill 2443, and it was one of the ones that we had to carry over from our last agenda. And Mr. Gallagher, could you remind us what that bill is about?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, that bill would adjust tonnage fees for fertilizer products to help fund the research necessary to identify actions and materials in those products on soil and water.
Okay, very good. That bill has not been amended. And I'm wondering if there's someone from the department that might like to come up and just, it's been a little bit since we've heard the bill, and just refresh our memories on that one before we work it. And my apologies, Lisa, for probably catching you off guard on this one. I didn't intend to do that.
She's always prepared.
But thank you. That's right. She is always prepared.
Always
so.
Prepared.
Right. Always on top of her game.
Good morning. For the record, Lisa Hansen, Deputy Director with the Department of Ag. I think Director Kova spoke with you about House Bill 2443 several weeks ago. The bill provides the ability for ODA to raise the registration and tonnage tax fees on our fertilizer products. The industry came to us several years ago looking to do some additional research on groundwater in a couple of groundwater limited areas. Excuse me. And with that, we moved forward, and we've been providing about $70,000 a year for the last 3 years. That work is still in progress. For us to continue to maintain our base fertilizer program, which does all of our regulatory work, our sampling, registration, inspection, et cetera, and continue the research at that level, we need to be doing a fee increase. We have worked with our industry partners on this to come to agreement on how to get there, and those elements are in this bill, as well as some other housekeeping around the nursery law.
Very good, thank you. And as I recall, we did not have any opposition to that, Mr. Gallagher. No. All right.
Mr. Chair, no.
I would say, Mr. Chair, there are times when the constituent base and the agency come together and agree that a fee is needed to service that industry. I look at that type of a fee increase or tax a lot different than one that starts some new program.
Okay, very good, and I think that's an important point to note. Committee members, this would be our opportunity, if there are any lingering questions or anything that anyone has, before I recognize Vice Chair Krieger on the bill, to ask Ms. Hansen if there's any anything that you want. Lisa, thank you so very, very much. Truly appreciate that. With that, I am going to recognize Vice Chair Krieger.
Chair Witt, I move House Bill 2443 to the floor with a due pass recommendation, and the bill be referred to the Joint Committee on Ways and Means.
Thank you very much. Vice Chair Krieger moves House Bill 2443 to the floor with a due pass recommendation, and that it be re-referred to the Joint Committee on Ways and Means. Is there any discussion on his bill? Seeing none, I'm going to call the roll on this. Would the clerk please call the roll?
Representative Moreno.
Aye.
Representative Esquivel.
Aye.
Representative Frederick.
He is excused.
Representative Gorsuch.
Yes.
Representative McEwen.
Yes.
Representative Woodson.
She is excused.
Vice Chair Krieger.
Aye.
Vice Chair Manning.
Yes.
Chair Witt.
Aye. Having received the necessary majority, the motion passes, and the bill is sent on to the Joint Committee on Ways and Means. So thank you very much for that. I am going to close the work session on House Bill 2443. And before we proceed, I'm going to just note for the record and for the public's consumption, apparently there has been a very tragic accident on I-5, which is now preventing a couple of our members from being able to attend the committee. So hopefully they will be able to join us here in a little bit. With that, I am going to open a work session on House Bill 2207. Mr. Gallagher.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, 2207 replaces an exception to the requirements of Oregon law relating regulating discharge of ballast water into waters of the state where that ballast water has been treated to remove organisms in a manner that is approved by the United States Coast Guard, with an exception where the water is treated pursuant to rules adopted by Environmental Quality Commission. And Brian Hook is here to chat a little bit more about that.
Great. Thank you. Thank you very much. Mr. Hoof, if you would be so kind as to come forward, and I think there may be, I know that there are a couple of questions. I don't know. There may be others. But, again, this is another one where I think the committee had some discussion. I don't think there was really a whole lot of opposition. But could you begin, sir, by telling us how the rulemaking on this, what it might look like?
Sure. Chair Witt, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Ryan Hoof from the Department of Environmental Quality. This bill, as amended with the -3 amendment, clarifies some rulemaking authority for the EQC. Our original intent was to proceed with a recommendation, a consensus recommendation from the Shipping Transport Aquatic Invasive Species Task Force to specifically address a concern about ballast operations that could represent a high risk for our waters, and that is vessels that are declaring no ballast on board, but indeed an empty ballast tank is never truly empty. It has residual water and sediments in it. That consensus recommendation, rather than putting those rules in statute, because there's still a fairly dynamic environment with some federal regulations, it was decided it would be better to put those in rule. And so our rulemaking process, we envision starting that perhaps mid to late summer. We may address a couple of other issues that are still having ongoing discussions with stakeholders about these issues, again, addressing some potential high-risk discharges to Oregon waters. Depending on whether or not these other issues are also addressed in rulemaking, we estimate the potential for maybe the total of about 2.25 months worth of staff efforts at DEQ to address these rulemaking processes. So not a major rulemaking effort under our estimation. Maybe taking a total from beginning of the proposed rulemaking to completion, maybe 10 to 12 months total.
Okay. And another question. I know in the testimony it was brought out that only 15% roughly, plus or minus, of the vessels are actually their tanks or whatever are actually inspected, that it's mostly the check of the ship's log. And I understand very well, and I think your testimony was very clear on this, that it is, I think, largely due to funding considerations because of that. And this may or may not be something that this committee wants to take to heart and maybe ratchet up the entire legislature's concerns about this, because again, as your testimony has pointed out, the waterways of the state are at peril should any of these foreign invasive organisms escape. So could you tell us, give us a feel for what might be necessary in terms of funding, and if I don't want to put you on the spot if you're not the best person to answer this, but we could seek the information elsewhere if necessary. But I'm just concerned what it would take to ratchet up that level of inspection.
Chair Witt, I will speak to what isn't currently in place in terms of funding mechanism. And the 1.5 FTE effort at DEQ for our ballast water program is supported by a 50-50 cost share between general fund allocation and fee revenue from a per vessel arrival fee that's instituted. Currently, that's $70 per arrival. Senate Bill 261, which has passed the Senate side, would raise that fee to $88 per vessel, and the intention is to maintain current service levels at 1.5 FTE, the goal of maintaining around a 15% vessel inspection rate. That is based upon the consensus recommendation from our stakeholder advisory group. That group did discuss other alternatives. We talked about what it would cost in terms of a fee amount and general fund allocation to achieve maybe a 2.0 FTE effort at DEQ, which might get us to around 25% vessel inspection rate. But what Senate Bill 261 is the recommendation of the task force, and that's what DEQ has been supportive of.
Okay. So. Very good. I appreciate that information. Vice Chair Krieger.
The 15% is the inspection rate. What's the actual analyzing of the ballast water? What percent of the ships do you do that on?
I'd have to get those exact numbers for you. When there's ballast tanks available for sampling and we're doing a boarding and an inspection, I would estimate 90 to 95% of the time we will take a sample. There are times, however, when by the time we get to the vessel, the ballast may have already been discharged, so there's no water to sample, and that might be a reason why we wouldn't. But overall, I would estimate that of the 15% of the vessels that we board, it's in the neighborhood of about two-thirds of them that we actually collect samples from. But I can get you the precise number if you'd like.
Thank you. Representative McEwen.
Thank you, Chair Witt. I just wanted to note the work that the task force did in coming to the provisions of Senate Bill 261. Is that the correct number? 261. negotiating that fee up was a balance. And we wanted to work very closely as a task force with the shipping industry to accomplish two things. And they were very, very amenable to increasing their fees to help solve the issue that we're discussing. But we also want to be very cognizant of the fact that if we put provisions on our shippers who come to berth in Oregon that are different than what's happening in the waters of the states adjacent to us, it does create some disadvantages for our shippers, which the ports across the river aren't very far away. So we do want to keep that balance between funding what needs to be done, making sure we have the provisions in place that protect the waters. I would support an increase in FTE to make sure, as Representative Krieger's drawn up, that we're inspecting enough vessels, particularly as, hopefully, we have an increase in vessel volume in other ports besides the Port of Portland, that we're ensuring that our waters are protected and safe. But that balance between putting our shippers at a disadvantage by putting rules on them that other states aren't doing yet. So we have that chicken or egg issue here with what's going on in Washington and at the federal level. And if we all move forward together, I think it's a reasonable thing to do that doesn't disadvantage businesses on this side of the river. But Senate Bill 261 was negotiated with the shippers. They were more than happy to up that fee so that we can provide more services and more protection for our inland waters in particular.
Very, very good. That's extremely helpful. Thank you. Representative Esquivel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. But does this not just maintain what we currently have? It doesn't expand it or do any more?
Chair Witt, Representative Esquivel, that is correct. It's maintaining current service levels with the fee increase is meant to accomplish maintaining current service levels through the 2017-2019 biennium. So looking out a little bit further.
And Mr. Hoof, it was my understanding that at some point, I don't know if it's still the case, but in the instance where vessels would be entering the Columbia River, I think it was whichever was the first port of call determined which state was going to do the inspection, but that it was shared back and forth between the states.
Chair Witt, that is correct. We work fairly closely with our counterparts in Washington State, with they're with the Department of Fish and Wildlife, trying to coordinate, making sure we're not having duplicative effort and having multiple ballast water inspections on a single ship on a port call.
And does that system seem to be working well, and is there good cooperation with our neighbor?
Chair Witt, yes, I think there is.
Excellent. Anything further? I have had a number of committee members come to me and express concern, and I think that you and the agency should feel free to, should the need arise, for support, ever cognizant of what Representative McEwen said about not, in essence, pricing ourselves out of the market. But you should feel that you have, I think, a great level of support among the members of this committee. Representative McEwen.
And Chair Witt, I really sincerely appreciate the sentiments of this committee in that regard. Mm-hmm. I think those of us who have worked through this would be heartened to think that we could create a more robust system, but this was done with an abundance of caution in a budgetary climate that's constrained. So we were being very, very careful. But if there is, if there is a spirit to do something different, I'm certainly the agency would be more than happy, and the task force would be heartened to think that there may be support above and beyond what we thought we were capable of doing in a constrained budgetary environment.
Thank you very much. And Mr. Huff, before we move on and take action on the bill, the Dash 3 amendments, could you remind the committee what those accomplish?
Indeed. Chair Witt, they really accomplish two things. One, it clarifies the rulemaking authority of EQC so that we believe the authority is there to address the issues that the task force has been discussing. And second of all, it also would distribute penalties that are collected on behalf of violations of ballast water management or noncompliance in our state, and it would distribute them instead of going to the general fund, it would distribute them to the invasive species control account, an account that's administered by the Oregon Invasive Species Council specifically for response, sort of an emergency control account for responding to new invasions in the state, not just aquatics, but also terrestrial environments as well.
And it's my understanding that that amendment has a general support from the public.
Chair Witt, that's my understanding as well.
Any further questions? Representative McEwen.
And Chair Witt, support from the task force.
Very good. Thank you. That's very helpful. Mm-hmm. Thank you, sir. Appreciate your availability and answering all of our questions. It's very helpful.
Thank you.
With that, committee members, if there's nothing further, I'm going to recognize.
Here, let me too, if you want.
I'm going to recognize Vice Chair Krieger.
Chair Witt, I move to adopt the Dash 3 amendments to House Bill 2207, dated 3/11/15.
Thank you very much. Vice Chair Krieger moves to adopt the Dash 3 amendments to House Bill 2207, dated March 11th, 2015. Is there any discussion on his motion? Seeing none, hearing none, is there any objection? Again, seeing none, the motion passes. Representative Krieger, again, please, sir.
Chair Witt, taking after you, I move House Bill 2207 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation and that the bill be referred to the Joint Ways and Means Committee.
Thank you very much. Vice Chair Krieger moves House Bill 2207 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation and that it be re-referred to the Joint Ways and Means Committee. Is there any discussion on his motion? I'm not seeing any. Would the clerk please call the roll?
Representative Verrato.
Aye.
Representative Esquivel.
Aye.
Representative Frederick.
He is excused.
Representative Borsuk.
Yes.
Representative McEwen.
Yes.
Representative Woodset?
Yes.
Vice Chair Krieger?
Aye.
Vice Chair McClain?
Aye.
Chair Witt?
Aye. Having received the necessary majority, the motion passes, and the bill is sent as amended to the Joint Ways and Means Committee. That motion passes. Thank you, committee members, very much. I am going to close the work session on House Bill 2207. And with that, we're going to recognize Paul and Committee. And Representative Reardon is here. And, sir, welcome to our committee. And
thank you. For the record, I am Jeff Reardon, Representative, District 48. And it is always a delight to be back joining you. And some of the, I was going to say old faces, but familiar faces from last session when I was part of this committee. And it was always the best issues that you get to grapple with. And anyway, it's good to be back. And this committee actually played a very important role in developing the bills that you're going to hear about today. And you passed a bill out of here to create a task force, a governor's task force, on pollinator health. And so the testimony that you're going to hear today is actually a result of that work of the task force. And so we'll make a few opening remarks and then let the some of the task force members come up and really explain what's going on. But this problem started, I brought an initial bill before you in the 2013 session, and it was evolved out of a concern with a massive bee kill off in Wilsonville, and there were a few other locations around the state, and trying to figure out what to do about that. And we ended up making a task force, and some people thought, oh, we should, well, actually, initially, I thought it should be more of just a ban on some neonicotinoids. I'm delighted that we ended up having a task force. And a task force was made up of people with some opposing views on the issues. You're going to hear from those folks today. But we were able to use kind of a consensus approach and think about what can we do to help advance pollinator health. And to me, it came down to doing a lot of it. What you're going to hear is a better, helping people better understand how do we coexist and how do we use chemical products effectively, safely as possible, and really deal with the problem. It got away from this idea of banning one product, because you know there are going to be other products that would follow in its heels. And then, so how can we reach out? How can we make people aware that there are issues, things they need to learn about? Just don't go to the store, buy a bottle, start spraying stuff. You really need to take care and concern about how you deal with pesticides. So,
and Representative Reardon, I apologize. I'm going to interrupt you just for a moment. But my mistake, and I believe that I failed to actually open officially the public hearing.
I don't have to do it over again.
No. On the individual bills. So I am going to open a public hearing on HCR 9, House Bill 3360, House Bill 3361, and House Bill 3362. Pardon me. So.
Oh, that's fine.
Like you said, some of these old faces, thank you.
Anyway, I think it's important to understand that. And these were not easy discussions at all. A lot of back and forth. But I think the products that you're going to hear about today are really right on and going to help really advance the issue. And so very briefly, part of it, we have a marvelous research center at Oregon State. You're going to hear from Dr. Segelli today, and he has kind of developed that over the last half a dozen years or so, just kind of on his own hook, and would like to help build that research center up a little bit, develop a diagnostics lab so that we have a better ability to deal with problems and when they occur and figure out what's going on. And then the part that I understand the best is that, as I mentioned earlier, make people aware, provide better information sources about how to deal with pests. And So with that, I would like, if it's all right with the chair, to ask if we could have Elizabeth Remley come up and testify first. She needs to be in another hearing about 8:30, and she was a full participant in this process, and she could tell us the Oregon Nursery Association, and I haven't looked around. Is she not?
And I'm not seeing her, and she indicated to me that she was doing double duty here this morning.
Well,
so
maybe she can make it back.
Yes.
With that, just call up whoever you wish.
Thank you so very, very much. Any questions or comments for our former committee member? Seeing none, Representative Reardon, thank you for bringing forward all of these very good bills. With that, I'd like to call forward, please, Professor Ramesh Sagili and Rich Little, Christy Split, I think that's three, no, and Harry Vanderpool, please.
Can we go on together?
Yes, please. Good morning and welcome to each of you. Please determine among yourselves the order of your testimony. And whoever, when you begin your statement, if you please introduce yourselves for the record, we'd appreciate that. Thank you.
I'm Harry Vanderpool, Vice President of the Oregon State Beekeepers Association. Mr. Chair, just a procedural. You opened all of the bills. How would you like to proceed bill to bill?
You can provide either general comments for all of them, or if you want to address a specific bill, you can you can tell us that I'm addressing which one it is.
Thank you.
Yeah.
House Bill 3360. House Bill 3360 is related to bringing the Oregon State University Honeybee Lab up to a state-of-the-art diagnostic facility. And I have some comments here for that. The estimated 70,000 commercial managed honeybee hives in Oregon pollinate more than 90 agricultural crops annually, with a market value exceeding $500 million. Oregon commercial beekeepers work very hard all year long to maintain strong, healthy honeybee hives for pollination of these crops. It is very hard work, and it is not getting any easier. In the 2014 OSU pollination survey, sideline and commercial beekeepers reported an average expense of approximately $200 per hive expenses in order to maintain strong, healthy hives. For a beekeeping operation of 2,500 hives, that equates to $500,000 of annual expenses just to maintain those hives. And remember, that's only 2,500 hives. Oregon has many commercial beekeeping operations much larger than that. Beekeeping on any scale delivers to the beekeeper nonstop, ever-changing challenges regarding pests and diseases that they must contend with. Becoming a successful beekeeper requires constant education and the ability to quickly recognize and correct the myriad of parasites, fungal and bacterial infections, viruses in many forms in the field, and the list goes on and on. Because the problems are forever unmasking and unfolding, where does a beekeeper go when something new shows up? You don't call a veterinarian for honeybees. Fortunately for Oregon beekeepers, we have one of the finest honeybee entomologists and honeybee researchers in the world. And that is Dr. Ramesh Sagili that we have with us here today. We are very grateful for him. Unfortunately, the tools at his disposal are very limited. Much critical analysis cannot be conducted at OSU. In fact, must be sent to the East Coast or beyond for answers. This is a travesty. We have in Oregon everything we need. We have the crops, we have the bees, we have the beekeepers, and an excellent scientist. The Oregon State Beekeepers Association is here today to ask this committee and the 78th Oregon Legislative Assembly to appropriate funding for Oregon State University for the purpose of developing a state-of-the-art bee health diagnostic facility at the Honey Bee Lab at OSU. We urge you to pass Bill 3360. Thank you, and I'm happy to take questions.
Thank you very, very much. Who's next?
Good morning, Chair Witt, and the esteemed representative, esteemed committee members here.
Good morning.
So I'm here today to testify on House Bill 3360 and 3361 because I chaired the task force, as many of you know. So I felt an obligation, and Representative Reardon invited me as well to be here to support this bill. And so I'll basically provide some additional information and also justify why we need this high-end diagnostic facility that we have requested in the task force. Sure. And so if you don't mind, I'll just go the PowerPoint. I have a few slides, and I'm just trying to make a case why we need a high-end diagnostic lab. So Rep. Reardon already went through all these things, how this Pollinator Health Task Force was evolved, and this was because of that 2014 legislative session, which was enacted House Bill 4139. And then we had several meetings, about seven meetings through June through October, and we submitted the report, I believe, around November or December. And then there were task force members. You see at least Rich and there, Christy, and then we have Scott in the back as well. So it was a very productive meeting, as Reardon mentioned, and we were able to achieve, despite all our differences, because it was a very diverse task force. So I'll just go over a few of those top recommendations that came out of this task force. So the first one here is to develop a strong, effective outreach and education strategy on pollinator health. And then the other one, which you saw in the Bill 3360, where we are asking for a state-of-art bee health diagnostic facility. And then there was also integrated pollinator health research plan, planned to be developed and funded, and then looking for all the funding streams for all those different proposals. I know I still recognize some of the committee members here. I gave a similar presentation probably in December, I guess, when I was testifying here. But again, my intention is not to go over all those again. But just to give, again, here I'm here today to justify why we need that state-of-the-art diagnostic facility. So I wanted to provide you some context before so that you have a better understanding of the needs of the beekeepers. I know you remember this picture, I guess, I showed you. So we are glad, as Harry mentioned, about the beekeeping industry here in the state of Oregon. We have about 70,000 hives, and then we are not in a situation like in some other countries, like in China, where unfortunately they have to use hand pollination and a lot of human labor in some crops because of lack of strong, healthy hives. But we are very fortunate to have these very big, excellent beekeepers and a very huge and very good beekeeping industry that we rely on for our pollination needs. So this is just to give you an overview of what's going on with the honeybee colony health status. So this is a national graph where we are seeing about 30% losses every year, and this is not sustainable. Again, I'm not seeing any threat to pollination industry today because there are still enough bees to pollinate our crops, but then that's the beekeeping industry is not going to sustain if they're losing 30% every year. It's very expensive to revamp those losses back again. So it is coming at a cost. It's not easy to manipulate those hives and come back to the same numbers what they had before. So again, what's going on with all these colony declines? Unfortunately, if you ask any bee researcher in the United States, we still put these three things there. It's complex, multifactorial, and dynamic, because there is no single pathogen or pest that we think is really responsible for all these colony losses that we are seeing today. So I have tried to put this slide just to give you a very big picture or an overview of all these different challenges that bees have today, from parasites and diseases. They have been there forever for bees, like there for any other organism you can think of. There is malnutrition, which is because of the diverse diet that bees are not getting today because of all the cropping systems we have, a very intense agriculture, lack of CRP land, and so many other factors that have played into this. Then pesticides, it's one component. It's not the major one that is already driving all these losses, but pesticides are always a stress, and then we are getting a lot of stress because of pesticides. Then there are miticides that beekeepers have to use to control some of those pests they have called varroa. I'm going to show you a picture in a minute. And then because honeybees are not native, as many of you probably know, they were introduced into the United States around 1600s, and now we are so reliant on these bees for our agriculture. So all these different factors are playing like a perfect storm, and that's what we are seeing. The immune system of the bees are being compromised, and then we are seeing higher losses. So there is not a single good explanation for this. So this is the mite. Again, I'm be mindful that I'm giving this context to show you how many different challenges the beekeepers have and how this diagnostic lab could help them. So this is a mite which has been there for in the United States for about 25 years now. It's an introduced pest as well and causes a lot of damage to the hives. I mean, if you ask a beekeeper, this is the number one problem still. And they carry a lot of viruses. You see that mite on your right. That's an ectoparasite, sucks the blood of the bee and transmits all those different viruses that I have listed on the lower right. And these viruses are eventually the ones that are taking the bees or declining the colonies. There are other pests like Nosema disease, which is a gut parasite that causes diarrhea in bees. Again, I don't want to go into all these because I know you are all aware of most of these things. And poor nutrition, as I mentioned before, the monocultures, the hybrid crops we have, and have almost declined or restricted the diet of the bees. So they are not getting a proper balanced diet like humans. They do need a balanced diet, and that could compromise their immune system. So these are several issues that are there. And of course, pesticides, and I know these have been in the news for the last 7 years, but pesticides have been an issue for a long time, and beekeepers have been managing with growers on how to deal with different things. And there are ways still beekeepers and growers can survive if there is a better plan on how to go with these applications of pesticides at the right time. And as Rep. Reardon was saying, there's a lot of awareness that needs to be created in this front so that we have less exposure of pesticides to bees. And coming back to the meat here, this is the one which the diagnostic facility in the bill, House Bill 3360, which asks for funding for honeybee health diagnostic facility. So the context I gave you on all these different challenges that bees have, I think probably it's very clear that maybe 30 years ago, I know beekeepers had a very easy life. They were able to, of course, I was not in research at the time, but they had an easy life, I realized. But after the introduction of mites and several other problems in the last two decades, it's been challenging. 30 years ago, probably the beekeepers were going to their hives once in a few months, and they were still having their colonies alive. But today, with all these challenges that I showed you before, they are playing a perfect storm. So if a beekeeper is not on top of those things, even for 2 weeks, there is a very good chance that they will lose those hives. And they need a lot of help. And again, they can't do themselves all this monitoring and looking for these new pests and pathogens. So that's the reason if we have, I mean, we do have a diagnostic facility. I was hired in 2009 at OSU as a honeybee researcher, and we have been helping beekeepers as much as we could. But we started from scratch, and we are grateful for the state as well. The funding that comes from my position is from the state, actually. So that was another emergency legislature money that came in and that's sustaining the lab. But again, here we want something more useful for the beekeepers where we can have some cutting-edge tools so that we can come back and tell beekeeper in a week's time. So that's what I say. Timely management of the hives is very critical, and for that, they need timely information. And that can be done only if we are funded with for establishing a high-end diagnostic lab or the state-of-the-art lab that I have mentioned before. So that's the beekeeper's end, but then the second line I say here is bee diagnostic facility will also assist the analysis of native bees, because I'm not ignoring the native bees here. They are very critical for pollination. They provide insurance when honeybees are not around for sure. So again, they have their populations, their problems have not been documented very well. So providing a diagnostic lab facility, we can also look at the pests and pathogens involved with native bees as well. So it's not just honeybees. I'm talking about other native pollinator help as well. And the last thing, there are several other advantages of having a lab, but again, I'm just focusing on the prime things. And Oregon Department of Ag also relies on us when there is a pesticide investigation. They need to figure out whether it was a pesticide kill or it was because of colony health problems with relation to pests and pathogens. So if we have this lab, we can also help ODA speeding up their investigations, looking at pests and pathogens as well. So those are some things. And again, I can go into more details if you have questions, but I'll stop there with that part. And then I am not sure if you are interested in all the other financial things that are involved in this, but the task force recommended 4 FTE, about $1 million for the biennium. And then there is money requested for equipment, which is basically capital expenditure, about $500K in there. But I also wanted to provide some update on what's currently going on with the OSU statewide programs request. So OSU statewide programs have requested about $16 million, and that's a Senate Bill 657, I believe. So there is about 2 FTE there, which could be used for this. So probably if we are funded only for two, if that, hoping that that bill passes and that money is in there, so then probably we'll need maybe there only $500K for the personnel here. And the equipment, of course, we really need that equipment. Without that, we can't establish a lab, and then having personnel is not any of any use because there is no diagnostic facility as well. So that $500K is very critical we are requesting as well as a part of this bill, I guess. Then outreach and education, as Rep. Reardon really put it the right way, that it's very critical, and there was a huge consensus among all the members of the task force on this is a very critical component. And so we had all these recommendations that you see here to develop appropriate educational information to reach the intended audience. It could be licensed pesticide applicators from homeowners as well. And OSU and ODA are currently conducting several of these activities to address all these problems. But again, if we want to do in a large scale, we really need support. And that's the reason why House Bill 3361, I think, talks about funding for extension as well. So this is the last slide I have. The task force recommendation was to support a direct appropriation to OSU extension for outreach and education on pollinator health. And again, it was very broad, so we haven't come up with a number because there are too many entities. For the diagnostic lab, it's just me, so I could give you a number. But unfortunately, for the extension component, there will be multiple OSU faculty, there will be ODA involved as well, and several other private individuals too. So that's the reason we didn't come up with a number, but again, that's a critical component. But again, with the OSU statewide program that I mentioned before, the Senate Bill 657, there is some request there for 1 FTE, about $250K for outreach and education. So that could help a little bit as well. I think I'll stop here and take questions if you have, or I can wait until then. Thank you very much.
Thank you very, very much. Who's next?
Thank you. I'm Richard Little. I'm a retired deputy agriculture machine who moved here from California about 4.5 years ago. I'm actually an entomologist. And I served on this task force because I have a passion for bees. Not so much honeybees, pardon me, but native bees. Because I feel that we are not paying attention to our food for the future. We got a problem. But before I get into that part, what I really wanted to share was the other one, which is 3362, the outreach part. I'm a volunteer instructor for the Extension Service. And I go around last year, these past 2 years, about 12 different counties, where my role is basically to instruct new master gardeners in basic entomology, integrated pest management, and bees, and how to protect them. In other words, this is the front line, because OSU does not have enough paid staff to do what I'm doing. I'm doing this with passion, by the way. So no, I'm not asking for money from me, see? Okay. But the thing is, we have to think of our future. And the thing that amazed me most when we put this task force together was the fact that we had people representing a wide diversity of industries and the public who came together and realized we need to set an example. And we did, because I think we came up with an incredible number of unanimous recommendations that we are asking you to follow up on. And part of it is these three bills. And as far as I'm concerned, that's just the start. And this is only the first, but by far the last time you're going to see me on this issue. So with that, I'll pass it on to Christine.
Thank you very much. Good morning.
Good morning, Chair Witt, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Christy Split, and I'm here representing the Oregon League of Conservation Voters today. I was really looking forward to having the opportunity to sit next to Oregonians for Food and Shelter in support of these bills today. So I told Scott when I was walking up here that would be great. It was really fun to be on this task force and actually find consensus on an issue related to pesticides, which we all know is controversial. But of course, as you've just learned, this is an issue that goes far beyond just pesticides and really does lead us to a place where we can find common ground. And so I'm really grateful that Representative Reardon brought forward these four bills that all had consensus out of the task force. And you've heard a lot about the bills. I don't want to get into them, but what I really want to do is implore all of you to help. We're going to pass these bills, hopefully we'll pass these bills on to Ways and Means, and we'll need your support to make sure that Ways and Means invests in these programs that we had this consensus on. This is a really important issue, and one where you could see these bills going down and going into the Ways and Means process, and who knows. But if we can all work together and make sure that the message is clear that these are important and they're consensus, and that we want to see some funding go into these programs so that we can have adequate education and outreach and have adequate research facilities, and I don't even think adequate would even probably cover it, just getting toward adequate maybe, that would mean so much to the people that worked on the task force, to all the beekeepers in the state, and really everyone who depends on bees, which means every single Oregonian. So thank you very much for the nodding heads and the careful attention I've seen you pay to Dr. Sigili when he was going through his presentation, and I know you've heard it before, but thank you for this committee continuing to pay careful and close attention to this important issue.
Thank you very much. Yes, sir.
Mr. Chair, I...
Would you identify yourself again for the record, please?
Harry Vanderpool, Vice President, Oregon State Beekeepers Association.
Thank you.
We have comments on 3362 as well.
Okay, fine.
Mr. Chair, would you like me to first read the paragraphs that I'm commenting from the bill to clarify? Or?
Your pleasure, sir, but that sounds like a good way to do it.
Okay, so in House Bill 3362, Section 2, Paragraph 2, application for apiary registration, licensing our apiaries or our beekeeping business or locations, shall be made on a form furnished by the government. The registration shall cover each colony of bees owned by the applicant and shall give the locations of such colonies a name and address, telephone number of the owner, and the name and address, the telephone number of the people in charge or the person in charge if it's not the owner. The registration shall be made before June 1st of each year for all colonies. Each registration shall furnish an address to which any notice required by this chapter to be given may be sent, and shall agree that any notice sent by the department to such an address shall be deemed to be notice in fact. Our comments on that. That ORS 602090 has been in effect for many decades. This was in effect many years back in the day when Oregon had a hive inspection program and hive inspectors that worked for the ODA. When the inspection program ended around 1989, the requirement for beekeepers to list each individual location on their hives on their annual apiary license was dropped. Still on the books, but the requirement was dropped. Here's my license. I got a whole stack of them going back decades. My name and address. I just want to make sure that everyone understands that the listing of commercial beekeepers' hives per location was a highly flawed requirement in its day and cannot have any accuracy without the institution of an elaborate, separate system of tracking. Section 2, paragraph 3 requires that registration along with the list of locations shall be made before June 1st of each year. Due to the continual movement of honeybee hives for pollination, the list will be completely inaccurate prior to July 1. In other words, the list will only be guaranteed accurate for the day it is written. Oregon beekeepers prefer to retain the system of providing beekeeper address and contact information on our licenses. That information should be accurate. As well, many beekeepers are asking, what about the tens of thousands of honeybee hives that come into Oregon from out of state to pollinate crops? What shall their requirement, registration requirements be? How will the ODA track their locations? So that's my comment on, that's our comment on that paragraph. Now, moving on, one more paragraph to comment on. That section 3, paragraph 2. Now, going to back up to section 2, paragraph 3, this bill institutes a 50-cent per hive assessment to be spent on research. So section 3, paragraph 2 reads, all monies collected pursuant to 602.090 shall be spent on honeybee and native bee research. I may need a bodyguard here, but the Oregon State Beekeepers Association requests that the language in section 3, paragraph 2 be amended to read as follows. All monies collected pursuant to 602.090 shall be spent on honeybee research at the Oregon State University Bee Lab. Oregon commercial beekeepers appreciate native pollinators as much as everyone in this room. We benefit from their pollination just the same as the clerks, reporters, legislators, everybody in this room. However, in our beekeeping operations and hives, we have absolutely nothing to do with native pollinators. We have no connection to any pollinators in our businesses and in our hives that are to be assessed a fee other than honeybees. For example, we could take a portion of the monies assessed on a per hive basis and fund salmon run restoration or oak savanna preservation. But of course, that would be preposterous. As commercial beekeepers, we conduct no work on salmon or oak trees. We also do no work with native pollinators. There is no basis or justification for any amount of the proposed per hive assessment monies to be spent on research other than honeybee research. And honeybee research is badly needed, as Dr. Segili pointed out. What we are talking about here in practice is an industry assessment. The industry that will pay the lion's share of this assessment is commercial beekeeping operations. If someone has 5 or 10 hives in their backyard, they'll pay a couple dollars. If you have 10,000 hives, you're looking at a $5,000 assessment for each year. The commercial beekeeping industry will pay the lion's share if this assessment is enacted. The research funded by this assessment should serve the funding source, mainly honeybees and beekeeping. In addition, paragraph 2 does not pinpoint the recipients of money. Of the monies collected for honeybee for honeybee research, we request that the monies collected are distributed to the Oregon State University Honeybee Lab for honeybee research. Many beekeepers are asking, what about the tens of thousands of honeybee hives that come into Oregon from out of state pollinate crops? What shall their assessment be? How will the ODA collect an assessment from them? So in conclusion, and I hate to mention this, you may want to check with the ODA on this, because if this bill is passed, it will be a voluntary compliance. ORS 602.090 has always been on the honor system. If you look at the list of registered beekeeping operations today, it is a list of the good guys and gals. Oregon has an estimated 70,000 managed honeybee hives, but only 137 currently registered apiaries. If we want to continue and increase participation with registration, fairness must be a core principle in this program. Thank you, and I'm willing to take questions.
Thank you very much. Mr. Vanderpool, I think have pointed out at least a couple of sections in the statute that, while it may not be a function of this bill, it's part of the state code that, number one, the listing of where the hives are and that sort of thing, I think your suggestion is that, A, it is inaccurate because of the movement. And I thought I was detecting, although I you didn't come right out and say it, that it's likely very invasive in terms of possibly personal and private information. I don't know if that was your intention.
Mr. Chair, for some people, and you know there's all sorts of different types of people, for some people that will have a much larger impression on them than others.
All right. And I think there's an opportunity here to advance an amendment on that if that's what you're interested in. I'll get back to that in a minute. The second thing is I think you've pointed out where some of the money that's raised in fees from the beekeepers is going to research possibly for native pollinators. And I understand your concern about that. The challenge that we would have at the state level is we have to find some nexus to levy that fee if we're going to continue to have this fee based. And while I think you've made a good point that we could use that money on oak savannas, and there's not much connection there. There is some modicum, some connection at least.
No.
Well, in any event, you're open to submitting an amendment for that as well, if you choose. And I would just say that I would caution you not to be putting in something at this point that could be divisive enough that it would possibly imperil the bill. Would be my only caution.
Mr. Chair, that is exactly the way I see this current language.
Okay.
It is way too divisive to be supported by the beekeeping community.
All right. Very good. Just my caution to you, and the way that you would proceed with an amendment would be to either approach any one of us on this committee, or perhaps the easiest and most direct way would be to contact Mr. Gallagher, and you can do that after the hearing.
Mr. Chair, there are agricultural entities that financially benefit from native pollinators. Those, I can see a linkage in some sort of monies collected from people that financially benefit from them. So that those revenue sources are there to be identified and discussed. And I just wanted to lay out that beekeeping operations are not one of them.
And I think, sir, you did a very good job of that. And I just wanted to make sure that you knew what options were available to you. With that, I'm going to recognize Vice Chair McLean.
Well, I appreciate the panel, and I was lucky enough. I think I got to see part of this presentation in an interim when I came and watched. And so I've been thinking about all of this. And, you know, I really agree with the sentiment that came along in the first part of the panel and from all four of you. And that is, we all benefit from pollination, and our food sources benefit. And it's something we need. It's something we can't do without. People who think pollination is extra to the process of, you know, of building food, you know, don't understand the process. But I think we're all on the same team. We need to develop a way for all of us to be comfortable and to be, you know, supportive of this, because, like you said, you know, we're at a nexus. There are all these issues that beekeepers, you know, have to face, as you well know, on the front line. And so whatever we can do to carry forward something this session means that some of those issues are going to be taken care of, you know, sooner rather than later, and so we need to do that. But let's remember, we're all on the same team. and we all care about the food sources for all of us, and we like local food sources, and we like to know that, that what we're doing here in the state is valuable for future generations and not just our generation. So I'm here to help with that, problem-solving situation, but let's have a good feeling about this, because you guys are the experts and you are the solutions to some of these things, because you're the raisers, you're the people who have the bees, and you're the people who are researching the bees, and we just want to keep this together. And so whatever we can do, whatever I can do, please help me with that. And I appreciate the concerns, and you know, the issue about the license, or you know, location. You know, I can always see from a researcher's perspective that everybody wants to know where those bees are, and neighbors want to know where those bees are. But the practicality of that seems like a pretty easy amendment. And if that's something we can do, let's do it. But the rest of it, you know, let's look at the integration of our services and the integration of our needs here, and let's figure out how to make that work.
Vice Chair Krieger.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I kind of have a question and then a comment. What's the difference in the lifespan between wild and domestic bees? Is there a difference in how long they live?
Most of the native bees that we're talking about, such as bumblebees, mason bees, and leafcutters, are what we would call annuals. They live 1 year. Mm-hmm. And most of them, they overwinter only as a single queen. So there's no hive, such as in a honey hive.
And sir, would you please identify yourself for the record again? And folks, as a panel, let me make the explanation. For the record, if 100 years from now somebody goes back and listens to this, because there's four of you, it makes it difficult sometimes to track who said what. So if, as you individually respond to questions, if you would please re-identify yourselves, we'd appreciate it. Thank you.
Be happy to. I'm Richard Little, a retired entomologist. And back to your question, most of the native bees that we're speaking of are what we refer to as annual. They have a one-year life cycle. The honey bees are biannual. They can go on continuously.
Please. Continuously, is that 1 year, 2 year, 3 year, 4 year? How long? In other words, what's the lifespan?
I will defer to you on that one.
Mr. Chair, Representative Krieger, it is... my name's Harry Vanderpool, Oregon State Beekeepers Association. Mr. Chair, Representative Krieger, the honeybee hive is an ever-regenerating organism. So the honeybee hive will have a population, and then occasionally a new queen will one way or another be introduced. And that hive can go on for 100 years if it doesn't collapse due to some reason, lose a queen and fail or a myriad of other problems that we as beekeepers have to pay attention to. But a healthy honeybee hive can go on forever. There is not a beginning and end. Or there's a beginning, but we hope. One thing I like about being a beekeeper is you don't take them to the butcher shop. You know, you maintain them for as long as they can go.
Just a comment, too. It kind of goes along. We're going to need a research lab, I understand that. We're just now in the process of funding the LC Salmon Research Center over on the coast, which is a great investment. And we're going to be looking at both wild and hatchery because they affect each other. And to do one or the other and exclude one, there may be an emphasis somewhere at different times in history that different things we may be looking for that might make us look at the wild, or they have an impact on domestic through disease or some other way, something we're not even aware of now. So simply to exclude it, I think the emphasis should be from where the people are supporting the dollars, but just like the fishermen and the commercial fishermen, both are going to be contributing for that research. So I think we have to be very careful that you don't take the chair's caution seriously.
Thank you very much. Representative Gorsuch, please.
To follow up on what Representative Krieger just said, Professor, you had indicated that we don't know much about wild bees right now. So would you say it's safe to say that there could be a connection between wild and domestic?
Yeah, okay. Chair Witt, Representative Gorsuch, this is Ramesh Sagiri, honeybee researcher at Oregon State University. That's an excellent question. So So, I mean, in nature we have seen there are some diseases that can be transmitted from bumblebees. Like I was showing that Nosema disease where the bees had diarrhea and other things. So it's a different species, but we have seen it's called Nosema bombi because bombus is the bumblebee, whereas honeybee is Apis mellifera. So there are connections because in the wild they are foraging on the same plants, same flowers. So if a bumblebee has a disease, and that could be transmitted to honeybees as well. So this disease transmission dynamics is a very complex issue. And so I think what Mr. Vanderpool is making a point is because this is more honeybee research focused, that they need money from whatever the money that is generated from beekeepers should go for that. But again, I don't think he's discounting the native pollinators. Maybe he's looking for a money that could come from a different source rather than directly from beekeepers. But again, coming back to your point, that's an extremely complex web where bees are interacting in the nature. So as Representative Krieger asked, the lifespans of these two. I know honeybees are perennial. That means they can go long, Mr. Vanderpool explained, until the queen dies or some colony collapse happens. But whereas in case of bumblebees and other native pollinators, only the queen survive the winter. So they hibernate and all the workforce that is all gone. So next year the queen comes out of those hibernating areas from the soil and rebuilds the nest again, and then the workers take up from there. So it's an annual cycle technically for a bumblebee. So again, yeah, we can't really tease apart the connections in the ecosystem or the web we have. But again, these are two different entities in terms of pollination, because no one is coming back to your question on the population of native pollinators. Unfortunately, we don't even have a baseline on what kind of diseases and pests they have. Because honeybee is the most studied organism, I would say, probably have been studied for hundreds of years now. But bumblebees and native pollinators have gotten into limelight only recently, where people are looking at what's happening with these native pollinators as well. So we still have to understand, again, I'm not very specialized in native bees. There are a couple of other faculty at OSU that do a little bit of native bee research, but not in a big scale. But as I said, the diagnostic facility can still look for pests and diseases of those native bees as well.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Professor.
Thank you. Representative Barreto.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Getting into the finances of this, I think you said there was a $200 a year maintenance cost per hive. This state-of-the-art facility would cost $16 million, I think is what we have down here. And so there's a cost to that. And part of the fees that you would pay would go to the research. So how much, and I'm going back to the $200, I would expect that cost to go down with more research that would lower your maintenance costs. But how many dollars collected from the fees would go to offset that $16 million that would be that would benefit your industry?
Mr. Chair, Representative Barreto, well, if we want to base on 70,000 hives, we're looking at $35,000.
Okay.
And those fees are based on honeybee hives out of honeybee keeping operations. They're not based on, but as Dr. Segele said, we don't even know what our populations of bumblebees are. There's no assessment on them.
Yes, but going back to the cost, it's a $16 million cost to the taxpayer, so you would be contributing $35,000 to that. And so I guess going back to your argument about the natural bees versus the domestic bees, the taxpayer would be paying the burden of this research facility.
Mr. Chair, Representative Barreto, there are $500,000 of value-added pollination due to honeybee pollination in the state of Oregon annually, with over 90 crops involved.
Sure.
The society benefits greatly by having food on the table. And I can't think of a bigger issue than that. And when we look at the monocultures that we're pollinating, they cannot be pollinated with anything other than honeybees. There are many crops in our monocultures that no bees, no crop. Now there's blueberries, squash. There are crops where no bees, you'll have some little crop that it won't be very lucrative for the grower. There are other crops, cranberries, almonds, seed pollination in the desert. No bees, no crop. So society benefits greatly by their investment in the honeybee industry.
Follow up?
Please.
Yeah, no, I don't disagree with that. And when you talk about dollars going into the economy, certainly there's a payback for that. I mean, in the private sector, in any industry, typically there is an R&D department. And so who pays for that R&D department is the issue that I like to bring up, and sometimes I get blasted for it. But in my industry, I pay for that. And so when you ask the taxpayer to pay for part of your R&D, you know, there's a responsibility that goes with that. And so I just wanted to make that point that, you know, the R&D department, if it's paid for, if the majority of it is paid by the taxpayer, you know, through economic tax dollars, then part of that natural science is justified.
This is, for the record, this is Christy Splitt and Representative Bretto, Chair Witt, and the rest of the committee. I just want to make sure that we're clear that the $16 million amount is not just for this. That's actually a huge bill. That's a program that would benefit OSU statewide across the state for a variety of programs. And I think between the two slides, it adds up to maybe $500,000 for the bee health diagnostic facility. $1.5 million, I'm sorry. And then there was an additional $500,000 for education and outreach. So it's only a portion of the $16 million total. I just wanted to make sure everybody understood that we weren't after $16 million for just...
Dr. Segil.
Chair Witt and Rep. Burrito, this is Ramesh Segil again from Oregon State University. Yeah, that's true. Probably I shouldn't have put that slide about $16 million. I was trying to update you on the Senate Bill 657 that's there, where OSU as an entity is asking for. There are several things, not just bees. Bees are just one part of it. I was just trying to get you some more information on if we are not asking for that entire $1.5 million. If something comes up from that statewide program request, maybe then we are not asking that much as well. But for bees, it's just only $1.5 million at this time, not $16 million. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Little, I not to put you on the spot, sir, but I'm good enough at reading body language that I know when somebody's uncomfortable. And should you have anything that you want to say, please feel free.
My apologies if it was that obvious. Yes, this is Richard Little. And speaking of the gentleman to the right, not once, not ever do those people who are with native bees insinuate that we want to replace honeybees. That's totally unrealistic. We need to protect them. And I agree with everything he's saying. At the same time, you must also realize there are a lot of other pollinators out there that do pollinate agricultural crops besides honeybees. And contrary to what he may be implying, my belief is, and there's others who believe with me, that some of those crops exclusively are better pollinated by other bees. So I don't want to take sides here. What we need to do is to protect all the pollinators. Mm-hmm. And that actually includes more than just bees, though the emphasis should be on them because that's where most of our food crops are. But we're going to supplement, not replace.
Very good. Thank you. Representative McEwen.
I have a thank you, Chair Witt. This is I'm hearkening back to something said very early in your testimony that bees weren't introduced to the North American continent until the 1600s. Mm-hmm. How were things pollinated prior to that?
I should answer that. Chair Witt, Rep. McEwen, I'm Ramesh Segili again from Oregon State. So before 1600s, I mean, when the European settlers were coming to the United States, and the funny part is they didn't bring bees for pollination. They knew how to produce honey with using these bees. So they introduced in those ships, like some, maybe they got 100 and one survived their journey, and then that's how they established those honeybees for honey production, basically. They were never meant to pollination. But then our agriculture system has changed. I mean, who expected there would be 880,000 acres of almonds in California? So right now we have 880,000 acres, and they need 1.7 million hives for pollination. Wow. So our agriculture has changed so much in the past 50, 60 years that we have become become more and more reliant on those. So before that, only these bumblebees, what Rich was mentioning, all the other native bees were doing the pollination for our apples or whatever we had before. But the cropping system has changed so much. Like a good example in Oregon would be hybrid carrot seed. I work with the hybrid carrot seeds in Central Oregon.
I will apologize. I think I misunderstood what you said. I understood you to say there were no bees here until then. There was a type of bee because something had to pollinate maize and all the
there were native pollinators.
Okay, great. Thank
you. Yeah, there was no honeybee, especially. So
sorry to take up your time, Mr. Chair.
Insectivores.
All right, very good, Representative Barreto.
Thank you. One more question on this. On the chart that you had up there, as far as the managed honeybee colony losses in the U.S., you have the top part of the graph is red, and then the bottom is blue, and there are percentages. And so the percentage lost in 2014 was down below 25%, one of the lower ones. What are the blue and the red designate?
Yeah, good question. I didn't expect that in my speed you could recognize even those colors. But yeah, again, Chair Witt, Representative Barreto, this is Ramesh Sagili, Oregon State University. So what blue is stands for, the 15% around that, what you see is an acceptable loss. So beekeepers can still, I mean, they will not complain much even if they lose about 15%. That's an acceptable loss for a year. But anything beyond that is not sustainable, and that's what the economic sustainability of hives comes into play.
Okay. Thank you.
Before I dismiss the panel, Dr. Sagili, it has to be extremely rewarding to you professionally to have so many people supporting the work that you have done and the work that OSU is doing in terms of bees, and to have so many people supportive of a world-class bee institute at OSU. Sir, is a tribute to the work that you have done.
Thank you very much.
Yes. Representative Whitsitt.
I was wondering how many bee institutes there are in the United States. I don't know if that's the right word, but...
Chair Witt and Representative Whitsitt, this is for record Ramesh Sagili from Oregon State University again. That's a good question. So honeybee, you'll be surprised. Like, I always joke, when I was doing my PhD at Texas A&M University around 2002, people would ask, what do you study? And I would say, I do honeybee research. They would say, do you even get a job after graduating? Because it's a very narrow field. You're an entomologist, and again, you're doing a very narrow research on bees. And now, after 2007, since this colony collapse disorder got into the press, and sometimes I say it's a blessing in disguise that bees were taken for granted for a while, but they have gotten attention. So coming back to your point, why I'm giving this background is, so honeybee research was not, bees have been studied for, at least honeybee has been studied for hundreds of years, but still, we still don't understand many of the aspects. There are only few labs. I would say USDA has, because they have these USDA ARS labs, there are only, they recently closed one in Texas as well. So there are only about five USDA labs, and the university systems have about, I would say, in all those 50 states, maybe half of them don't even have a honeybee lab. Even before I came here, my predecessor retired in 2002, Mike Burgett, and then I was hired in 2009. So for a seven-year period, there was no position. That's what I said. The beekeepers and producers in the state, we should be very appreciative of their efforts to get this position back at OSU. So there are not too many. There are only a few. I would say, if you want me to get a number, just to throw a number, maybe there are 20 or 20-plus labs in the United States, excluding the USDA, which are about five or six.
Thank you.
Thank you very much to each of you. Thank you for your testimony, and we certainly appreciate your appearance today.
Thank you.
With that, I'd like to call up, please, Scott Dahlman. Is Elizabeth Remley back yet?
No.
And Roger Beyer, please. And is there anyone else from the public who'd like to testify on any of these bills at this point? All right. Gentlemen, good morning. Who's first?
All right, Chair Witt, members of the committee, My name is Scott Dahlman. I'm the Policy Director for Oregonians for Food and Shelter, and thank you for the opportunity to speak to you about this package of bills today. Just as a reminder, OFS is a grassroots coalition made up of farmers, foresters, and other pesticide users. We focus on issues involving pesticides and technology. I want to make it clear today, we are all concerned about bee health. Both farmers and beekeepers have a significant amount of skin in the game, if you will. Oregon farmers depend on bees to pollinate their crops, but also depend on the pesticide tools to control destructive pests. Similarly, commercial beekeepers rely on healthy crops to optimize their pollination services. This means the growers and beekeepers have a lot at stake in this conversation, and each share a vested interest in ensuring that protecting bee health and the use of pesticides is not mutually exclusive. You've heard a lot of this already today, and you heard a lot of this last year. Of course, as many of you remember, the 2014 session, a bill came to you that would have restricted the use of neonicotinoid pesticides. And through some collaboration, this group, this committee decided that that was not the right way to move forward, but that there are concerns with pollinator health in Oregon, and sent us off to a task force. So 10 of us, including myself, met over the last year. We met 7 times over the summer and released a report, which I know you've seen a copy of the full report, that had 4 priority recommendations. What we found as we met in that group very quickly is that bee health really has no simple answers to it. There's a wide variety of issues that are contributing to bee health declines, including mites, disease, pesticides, genetic diversity, nutrition, and all of these working together are contributing to the losses that we're seeing. So that's why the task force, after spending all that time together, came forward with some ideas that we thought would promote pollinator health going forward and stuff that we could all agree on. That's the package that's sitting in front of you today. We are supportive of that package overall, but I do have to make a note that 3362, as it is currently written, would not actually, it was accidentally written in a way that would not actually provide any dollars for this program, just because of the way it's written in the statute with the cap on pesticide fees versus what's actually under rule charged by ODA right now. It wouldn't result in any dollars for it. So we've been working with the sponsor of the bill on an amendment. I understand it's been drafted. We haven't seen it yet, so I have to hold back on our full support of that bill until we see something that actually will provide some dollars in the way it should. But hopefully we'll be able to come back to you with that and be fully supportive of all of that. So with that, you've seen a wide variety of people up here, groups that aren't always on the same page, and I think that some good work came out of this task force, and we thank you for considering the package.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Roger Beyer. I'm here representing the Oregon Seed Council. I, like everyone else, support pollinator health, and so does the Oregon Seed Council, even though grass seed is not pollinated by bees. It's a wind-pollinated crop. I would like to just focus my testimony today on just Section 4 of House Bill 3362. You just heard from Scott about the way it is drafted. We have concerns about the way this bill is drafted. Under current law, there's a cap on pesticide registration fees in statute of $250 per year. Registrants pay that fee as they license pesticide products, but we all know they don't really pay the fee. They pass it on to the growers who pay for the pesticide. This bill eliminates that $250 cap and makes it blank. And I don't know what the intent of the committee is, but we cannot support this bill moving forward unless there is a cap, and we support the $250 current cap in statute. So that's where I wanted to keep my comments focused on this bill. The Seed Council supports the statewide funding package. We believe that's an appropriate place for the funding for pollinator health to be in. I believe there's at least 2 positions in that package to be, you know, targeted toward bees, toward pollinators. We think that's an appropriate place for it. I look forward to seeing the amendments that are spoke of to see how this issue gets fixed before the bill moves out of the committee. So with that, Mr. Chair, I'd be happy to take any questions.
Thank you very, very much. Any questions or comments for these two gentlemen? I'm not seeing any. Thank you very, very much. Is there, before I ask for Representative Reardon to come back is, I don't see Elizabeth back yet. Last and final call for general public testimony. Seeing none, Representative Reardon, not to put you on the spot, but would you care to?
For the record, I am Representative Jeff Reardon, District 48, and thank you for calling me back up. I just became aware yesterday that there were concerns about the aspects of House Bill 3062 that were raised by Mr. Vanderpool. And so I'm happy to continue working on those to address his concern about identifying all the locations. That does seem rather onerous to me. I have an amendment. I apologize for not mentioning this earlier. I do have an amendment in process. I thought you might have received it by now that tried to clarify the part around the registration fees. We have no intent to raise it above the $250 mark. What we're trying to do is identify a certain dollar amount of that registration fee to be dedicated to the outreach program. So it's trying to be a little bit of this self-funding. That was something the both discussions about the apiary fees and registration fees that are in that bill came up on the work group. And I must tell you, I was very delighted to see people from industry willing to step up and they can afford to fund all of the that needs to be done, but at least step up and make a significant contribution. So I will continue to work on 3062 if you can give me just a little bit of time to get that amendment turned around.
Perfect. Anything for Representative Reardon? I'm going to ask that the folks who have expressed any concerns work with Representative Reardon. I can't believe it's going to take any great amount of time at all to address.
I think part of it's done.
To address everything. I mean, I think these are some relatively very, very easy fixes. And we'll be looking forward to being able to move all of these bills here in very short order.
Okay. And I really appreciate that. Again, it's a pleasure to be here, and thank you for your support.
Well, thank you, Representative, for bringing these bills forward. Elizabeth Remley, would you care to testify? I know you were signed up and you had double duty this morning.
I'll be brief.
All right.
Hard to follow Representative Reardon, though.
Good morning.
Chair Witt and members of the committee, I'm Elizabeth Remley, here today on behalf of the Oregon Association of Nurseries. Really trying to do my best Jeff Stone impression. I can't promise anything today. The nurseries, as Jeff likes to say, are pro-stripe. We love bees. We wouldn't be an industry in Oregon without them. We're just maybe even more embarrassed about what happened. Both bee die-offs happened on National Pollinator Day, and happened because of some mistakes by our members. So we definitely have a stake in this task force and what's come out of it, and we're very, very supportive and grateful for Representative Reardon's time and Senator Thompson's time, and we're very looking forward to continuing to have these conversations, and we encourage you to support these efforts. Thank you.
Thank you very, very much. Questions for Ms. Remley? Thank you for your testimony,
thank you.
And thank you for the extremely responsible approach that your organization has taken. Again, last and final call on House bill or any and all of the House bills that we've been hearing this morning. Seeing none, I'm going to close the public hearing on HCR 9, House Bill 3360, House Bill 3361, House Bill 3362. And we're going to, in a minute, after we hold our a very short work session here, we're going to, I'm going to ask for a motion to suspend the rules so that our colleagues who are tied up this morning can vote on the two previous ones. With that, I'm going to open a work session on House Concurrent Resolution Number 9. Mr. Gallagher, we've heard testimony, but I'm going to ask you to tell us specifically what this resolution does, please.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, HCR 9 recognizes the importance of insect pollinators and urges support of programs to ensure safety and vitality of pollinator populations.
Very, very good. Committee members, this is a quick turnaround. We heard the testimony this morning. Any questions at this point? If there are none, I'm going to recognize Vice Chair Krieger.
Chair, would I move HCR 9 to the floor with a due pass recommendation?
Thank you. Vice Chair Krieger moves House Concurrent Resolution Number 9 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion on his motion? Seeing none, hearing none, would the clerk please call the roll?
Representative Meadows.
Aye.
Representative Espel.
Aye.
Representative Fredericks.
Aye.
Representative Forsyth.
Yes.
Representative McEwen.
Aye.
Representative Woodson.
Aye.
Vice Chair Krieger.
Aye.
Vice Chair McLean.
Aye.
Chair Whip.
Aye. Having received the necessary majority, the motion passes. And I am going to ask that Representative Reardon carry this to the House floor. And with that, I'm going to close the work session on House Concurrent Resolution Number 9. Colleagues, I would accept a motion to allow two of our colleagues, Representatives Whitsitt and Frederick, to vote on the bills that they missed earlier. Representative Esquivel.
Yes, Mr. Chair, I move that...
suspend the rules?
We rule suspension and allow Representative Frederick and Representative Whitsitt to vote on House Bill 2207. Is that
and it would be 2443 was one, too. So.
2443. One of them missed one on 2443, and the other one did not.
Okay. I think just for clarity, to be able to manage it, I'm gonna say that Representative Esquivel moved suspension of the rules to allow Representatives Whitsitt and Frederick to vote on 2443. Any discussion on his motion? Any objections? So passed. Representative Whitsitt, how do you vote on, first of all, the two bills, or this particular bill would increase registration and tonnage fees on fertilizers. The bill was supported in the original vote. I do not believe that your two votes will in any way change the outcome of that vote. Representative Whitsitt, how do you vote?
Aye.
Representative Whitsitt votes aye. Representative Frederick, how do you vote?
Aye.
Representative Frederick votes aye. Going to so ordered, and I'm going to recognize Representative Esquivel for a motion with respect to Representative Frederick on House Bill 2207.
Yes, Mr. Chair, I request rule suspension and to allow Representative Frederick to vote on House Bill 2207.
Thank you very much. Representative Esquivel moves to suspend the rules to enable Representative Frederick to vote on House Bill 2207. Is there any discussion on their motion, on his motion? Any objection? All right. Before you vote, Representative Frederick, this one was the ballast tank issue, and there was a dash 3 amendment. I do not believe that your vote will change the outcome. Sir, how do you vote?
I vote aye.
Representative Frederick votes aye on House Bill 2207. So ordered. And with that, colleagues, is there anything for the good of the motion, good of the order this morning? Representative Whitsitt.
I just want to thank you, colleagues, for allowing us to vote.
Thank you very, very much. I also want to recognize the great job that Vice Chair Krieger, along with the other chairs of the Sportsman's Caucus, did last night for those of us who were in attendance, and there were a number of us. That
was the event. It was a fine evening.
That was the event so far this session. So
you didn't get to check. Were you one of those that stood up?
Yeah, I... Yes. I confess, sir.
What was that? What did you say?
Krieger was standing, too.
Oh, okay. All right. I feel...
Rightfully so.
Oh, yeah. I had to stand up on that one.
I did, too.
Ticket for $10 in 1965, because that's the first year they did the timetable for migratory waterfowl. And I was 7 minutes over.
Well, there you go.
With a flashlight.
Worthy of a ticket.
Not 7 minutes, I'll tell you.
It's got a searchlight up there.
With anything further for the good of the order? Seeing none, thank you very, very much, members. We are adjourned.
Thank you.
It was a fatal accident.
We are adjourned.
Thank you.
Abbott last night.
It was a fatal accident.